Muchas gracias por su invitación de estar aquí en la Ciudad de México. Solo hablo un poco de español, pero quiero agradecer a todas las personas que me invitaron aquí hoy día, sobre todo Carolina Ibarra y el Instituto de Investigaciones Históricas. Es un placer para mí aparecer en México y siento no poder hacer toda mi presentación en su idioma. Permítanme estas algunas palabras en español y perdónenme por cambiar ahora al inglés. Sorry, wish I could do this all in Spanish. What I'd like to talk about here with you today is the entry of the United States into the First World War almost 100 years ago, last month 100 years ago in 1917. It is a topic that American historians have not covered very well. It's something that we haven't studied very often. And the book that just got mentioned, The Path to War, is my attempt to take a new look at American entry into the First World War and try to better explain why the United States did what it did, and to try to understand that not just in American context, but to understand that in an international and global context. So that's what this first kind of cartoon postcard is designed to show. This is from 1915. It shows an American bull terrier dog saying, "I'm neutral, but I'm not afraid of any of them." And it is surrounded by an English bulldog, a German dachshund, a French bulldog, and a Russian wolfhound. I was just in the Parque Hundido this morning watching everybody walking their dogs. It got me thinking about this. Mexico is not a part of this postcard, but as I hope to show you here, Mexico features importantly in this history of American entry into the First World War, both Mexico's impact on the United States and, of course, America's impact here in Mexico. So really what I want to do in the next 40 minutes or so, and then I'll take questions after that, I really want to take you on a journey that I want to use this man to show. This is Walter Hines Page. He was America's ambassador to Great Britain. And when the war began in 1914 in Europe, he wrote President Wilson a really important letter that ended with these two sentences: "Now and ever, I thank heaven for the Atlantic Ocean. Thank God we are out of it." In other words, this doesn't concern us at all. Now I'd like to show you a letter he wrote just over a year later, about 14 months later, in which he said, "If Germany wins, the Monroe Doctrine will be shot through," which might have been good news here in Mexico, but was not good news in Washington. "We shall have to have a great army and navy," which Walter Hines Page meant negatively. He meant that national security, for which the United States had never had to pay before, it would now have to pay. "But suppose that England wins. We shall then have merely an academic dispute with her. It is a matter of life or death for English-speaking civilization." And what I was interested in the book is how Americans went from "thank heaven, thank God we are out of it," to life or death situation. And Walter Hines Page is ahead of the American people a little bit, but he's symbolic of this transition. And the transition, I think, is complete by 1917, for reasons that I hope to show you here, in the American mindset, from "this is somebody else's problem" to "now it is our problem. Now it is something that we need to be concerned about." And again, as I hope to show you here throughout this presentation, Mexico is an important part of this, even if sometimes American historians don't think about Mexico. Now, as I said, most American historians that have looked at this problem, I don't think have looked at it particularly carefully. They've looked only from the viewpoint of President Wilson, and I think they've misunderstood a lot of what the American people were doing and thinking. So in the book, I try as much as I can not to keep President Wilson at the center of this and to look at what the American people were thinking. And along the way, I learned a lot of the myths that I had been taught as a student about the First World War and the United States are simply not true. And so what I'd like to do is just show a little bit of that and then explain what the American people are doing. The first myth that I'd like to kind of shatter or change is the idea that the American people were isolationist and were not paying attention to the world in Europe or what was going on in Europe. And it's simply not true. Every newspaper, every letter, every diary, every memoir I've read from the period shows that Americans were interested in this war from the very second that it began. They knew it was going to be one of the most important events of their lives, and they knew that it was going to affect their lives immediately and directly. And what I have on this slide is an advertisement for a journalist named Richard Harding Davis, who was probably the most famous journalist in the United States when the First World War broke out. He was a friend of Theodore Roosevelt's. He was well known. He was a household name in the United States. When the war began, Davis got on the first ship that he could, it turned out to be the Lusitania, and went to Europe to begin covering the First World War in Europe. And this is an advertisement from my hometown paper, the Pittsburgh Gazette Times, telling its readers, subscribe to our newspaper because we're going to have the dispatches from Richard Harding Davis. We have that to bring to you. And as I hope to show you, the American people were using these dispatches and learning about the war through them. Another very famous journalist that went to war is this woman, Mary Roberts Rinehart. She was a mystery writer. She wrote crime novels before 1914. This is the most famous of those, The Circular Staircase. Now, as a researcher, I decided to go ahead and read it. I can tell you that it's not very good, but she was also very famous for articles she had written for the American magazine, The Saturday Evening Post. And when the First World War began, the Saturday Evening Post hosted a dinner in New York City for her and offered her the extraordinary sum of $1,000 per article if she would go to Europe and cover the war for the Saturday Evening Post. The Post's editors arranged for her to go into the trenches of the Western Front. She was the first woman allowed in as a reporter. And they arranged for her to visit Kaiser Wilhelm in Germany, the King and Queen in England, and the President of France. She left in late October of 1914, and she stayed in Europe until March of 1915. And her dispatches are very important to me for four reasons. The first is that she went to Europe, as did Richard Harding Davis, believing that all the countries of Europe were more or less equally responsible, that they had all somehow gotten into a war that they should have avoided. Within a couple of weeks of being in Europe, however, she, Davis, and most American reporters concluded that Germany was the country that was responsible, that it was Germany that had taken a small crisis in the Balkans and turned it into first a continental war, and then by invading Belgium, had turned it into a world war, by invading Belgium and bringing Britain in. Second, like Richard Harding Davis, she told her readers not to believe what the British media was telling them. That is, the British are trying to pull us into this war. Don't fall for it. Believe what we Americans have seen with our own eyes. And I think that's very important. Third, she argued that the United States should want Britain and France to win this war, but the United States itself should not get involved in the war unless American interests were threatened. That is, America should not go to war to rescue Britain and France. And please keep that in mind because it's a common theme that I want to talk about. And finally, she noted how awful, how modern, how technological this war was. And she warned her American readers, the United States should get ready now either to fight this war or to be strong enough so that the European great powers don't interfere with our affairs. This is a different kind of war than the ones the United States had fought before. Now, as I mentioned, she came back to the United States in March of 1915. In other words, just about 2 months before the sinking of the Lusitania. This is a page from the diary that she kept. Now, some textbooks, including the one my daughter uses, say that the United States got involved in the First World War because the Germans sank the Lusitania. Now, the sinking of the Lusitania was in 1915. The United States waited 2 more years to get involved in the war. So obviously, the Lusitania didn't cause American entry into World War I. What it did do, however, is force Americans to begin thinking about the war the way that Mary Roberts Rinehart had suggested. And she became a leader of a movement that became known as preparedness, meaning getting the United States ready in the event that it would have to fight. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit here about why that didn't work as well as she and others wanted. But the main point that I want to bring out is that it is the Lusitania that makes Americans aware that they cannot ignore the war in Europe. It was going to affect them. Exactly how the United States ought to respond were questions on which Americans did not agree, but the Lusitania highlighted how important this was going to become. This is a remarkable cartoon from October of 1915 showing, I want to use it here to show, growing American anger at Germany. This is the Kaiser wearing an Ottoman fez and holding an Ottoman scimitar sword while blood drips from the blade. And the text that accompanies this blames Germany, not the Ottoman Empire, for the massacre of the Armenians in eastern Turkey. The argument is that it isn't the Ottoman Empire that's doing this, it's actually the Germans. And the Lusitania, Armenia, and other events that go on in the United States increase American fears of Germany. And that includes Mexico, where Americans believe, from President Wilson on down, that Germany is playing politics here in Mexico, that Germany is looking for anti-American political leaders in Mexico whom they can back, whom they can give money to. And if you know your history of the First World War, you will know that Germany did this in Ireland in 1916 by supporting an uprising in Dublin. The British did it in the Middle East by supporting the uprising of the Arabs. And most famously, the Germans did it by inserting Lenin into Russia to create a revolution there. So this is not an idle fear that the United States had, that Germany is actively engaged inside Mexico. And I'll show you a little more of that as I go forward. Still, the American government responded very, very slowly to what it saw as the growing pressures of war in Europe. And the reason it moved slowly had much more to do with domestic politics inside the United States than any question of what was happening outside. And I can talk more about that in question and answer if anybody would like. What that did is mean that the task of preparing America for war fell mostly to private citizens and to private industry. Individuals and corporations took up this call. So the famous inventor Thomas Edison created a committee for American scientific preparedness. Charles Mayo, who later founded the Mayo Clinic, one of America's most famous hospitals, created a committee for American medical preparedness. And you can see in this ad, the American Telephone and Telegraph Company argued that it, not the U.S. government, could create a system of communications from coast to coast. And if you see the ad behind me, in the circle there is Paul Revere, who in 1775 made a famous ride through Boston, warning people in Boston that British ships were landing in Boston Harbor. The rest of that image is taken up by an American Army major on a telephone with the map of the Bell telephone system behind him. And the text here reads that it is Bell telephone that will be that system that will help America meet its next great challenge. Now, it's also true that the United States was making a lot of money off of this war. This is April of 1915. This is a cartoon in a Chicago newspaper from one of the first people to win a Pulitzer Prize for editorial cartooning, John McCutcheon. And if you look at this cartoon very carefully, you'll see that the docks of New York City have become magnets. And they are pulling the hard currency, the gold and silver, of Britain, France, and Germany away from Europe over to the United States. Uncle Sam has his arms wide open to greet this money while the Europeans look on in fear. Everybody in the United States was profiting. American per capita income in 1914 was $1,100. By 1916, it had risen to $1,800. That's an enormous increase for a country whose economy was in recession when the First World War began. Now, this came partly because Americans were selling things to the Europeans, mostly to Great Britain, selling industrial goods, selling food, selling clothing, selling cotton. It also meant that the American people were buying items from other Americans that they had normally bought in Europe. And one of the strangest things I came across when doing research for this book was a report from an Association of American Bible Salesmen who reported that 1915 was the best year in the history of American Bible sales because Americans used to buy their Bibles from Europe. During the war, those Bibles aren't being printed in Europe anymore. The same was true of eyeglasses. Americans began to buy eyeglasses, pencils, bicycles. Before World War I, those were items Americans bought in Europe. As a result, American income is going through the roof. And you can see that here. This is showing American trade balance with Europe. And you can see that when the war began in August, America had a negative trade balance with Europe. You can see how quickly, however, that turns around. Now, this is a problem for a lot of Americans. And you can see what Mary Roberts Reinhart said here. Her hometown, Pittsburgh, my hometown, Pittsburgh, she said, was fattening on catastrophe. That is, Americans were making a lot of money because of the suffering of other people. Ministers in churches on Sundays would say the same thing. What does it say about us as a country? If we recognize something terrible is happening halfway around the world, but all we're willing to do is make money from it. And again, I think when you think about the First World War in this way, it doesn't seem so long ago to me. Right? This is a common problem America is facing right now. When we see something terrible happening on the other side of the world, what is our responsibility to it? And it's the same question that Americans were asking 100 years ago. Can the United States go on as a country proclaiming the moral high ground while making this much money? Especially when by this point most Americans believed that Germany had to be defeated. What is it that the American people should do? Well, the easiest thing to do is to take a little bit of that money that you're making and give it away. And this is an ad, again, it's coming from my hometown. I had to do it. This is from the amusement park that I grew up riding roller coasters at. This is a day where all the money raised at Kennywood Park would go to help the people of Serbia. The American people gave a lot of money away in the years when America was neutral. As near as I can calculate, about 95% of that money went to four countries. It went to Belgium, it went to France, it went to Poland, and it went to Serbia. That is, very little of it went to the Ottoman Empire, to Germany, or to Austria. In other words, Americans were putting their money where their hearts and their heads were. The city of Philadelphia raised $100 million for Belgium by itself. That's a tremendous amount of money. Philadelphia's Jewish community raised $200,000 for relief of Jews in Poland. We think of World War I, we think of the Western Front, where the front didn't move very much. But in the East, the front moved often, and it tended to move right through Jewish communities, creating tremendous suffering. And this money was intended to relieve that suffering. Now, many Americans gave much more than their money. Many Americans put their own lives on the line to go to war for France. These are men, all American, most of them pretty wealthy, who volunteered to form their own squadron inside the French Air Force, which became known as the Lafayette Escadrille, named after the Marquis de Lafayette, who came from France to the United States and fought with George Washington in our revolution. The man with the giant lion you see there, or hidden by the giant lion there, is a man named Billy Thaw, a very, very wealthy man, the first person in the United States to own his own airplane. When the First World War began, he moved to France, and he helped to form this unit. All of the men you see here are Americans, and they're flying in a combat squadron inside the French Air Force. Now, if you notice in the picture, this is an eccentric and fairly odd group of men. The mascots they have for their squadron are two lion cubs. You can see them both in the picture. Their names were Whiskey and Soda. I don't know how they kept that little dog away from the lions, but they did. And they were all very wealthy. On top of that, wealthy Americans like Theodore Roosevelt, like Cornelius Vanderbilt, the railroad magnate, gave them even more money so they could live a crazy lifestyle. They flew in their pajamas when they wanted to. They held enormous dinner parties. For the French, they were a perfect public relations resource. There was no reason to force discipline on them. They were good pilots, and they were willing to fly and die for France. In fact, two of the men in this picture were killed flying for France. For the United States, the Lafayette Escadrille represented America being willing to put something more than money on the line for the cause they believed in. This is the memorial that the French built for the Lafayette Escadrille when the war ended. It's in Western Paris. There is a Canadian researcher, a good friend of mine named Jonathan Vance, who has estimated that as many as 80,000 Americans may have left the United States, gone to Canada, and volunteered for the British Army in Canada. That is 80,000 Canadians, who fought in World War I might in fact be Americans. 15,000 Americans went to New Orleans and joined the French Foreign Legion in New Orleans. Now, this is showing to me a country that is not neutral anymore. This is a country that is putting its money, putting its lives, and putting its young men on the line in order to fight for the cause they thought was right. Now, all of that explains why men like Billy Thaw and the Lafayette Escadrille went to Europe. It doesn't explain why the United States as a country decided to go to Europe. Now, to do that, I want to show you a map. This is the cover image of Life magazine in 1916, February of 1916. And the first thing that I'd like you to note on this map is the date, February 10th, 1916. In other words, this is very early in America's neutrality period. This is not 1917, it's 1916. And I'd like you to note a couple other things that I would just like to point out on the map. I showed this map in Canada about a month ago, and you'll notice that it labels the Canadians as barbarians. I'll come back to that in just a moment. I don't think this is referring to the Canadians themselves. If you notice, most of the map has the United States labeled as New Prussia, with cities like Washington, D.C. being called New Berlin, with New York City being called New Hamburg, with Pittsburgh, my hometown, being called New Kruppsburg. Okay. The fear that this map is articulating is that if the United States continues to do nothing in its own defense, this is what its future will look like. It will become, as one American reporter noted, the next China, a wealthy country that could not defend itself and then got picked apart by the European great powers. You'll notice also on this map, Baja California, the peninsula below California, is labeled as Austriana. In other words, it is to be given to Austria when the war is over. You'll notice Florida is labeled as Turconia for Turkey. And then there's that wonderful reference with Canada being called barbarians. I have a lot of friends in Canada. Like I said, I showed this in Canada just a month ago and had a lot of fun with it at an audience in Calgary. Here's what I think it's referring to. If Germany puts enough pressure on Britain, one way Britain might be able to get out of the war is by giving the Germans some of what it owned here in North America. And remember, this is what the European great powers had done throughout history. It's how Florida changed hands. It's how Louisiana changed hands. It's how most of the Caribbean changed hands over the years. What would happen, this map is asking, if Germany put enough pressure on Britain that as the price of peace, Great Britain gave much or all of Canada to Germany? This is the period when the United States first seriously began to think about how to defend the Caribbean Sea. The United States opened the Panama Canal in 1914, meaning that that's a very serious issue. It's in 1916 when the United States built its first serious defenses in Puerto Rico. It's in 1916 that the United States bought the Danish Virgin Islands and made them the American Virgin Islands. The idea was to keep those islands away from Germany. It's in this time period when the United States seriously proposed giving Great Britain $100 million to buy Canada so that the Germans wouldn't get it in a post-war peace. In other words, what this map is suggesting is that if the United States doesn't do something to defend itself, this is the future that it faces. Now, two other things to note on this map, and you'll note that I've left Mexico to last here. Mexico is here listed as the province of Mexico, with the capital city as Wilhelmsburg, after the Kaiser of Germany. And again, this is reflecting the concern among Americans that Mexico is becoming a de facto German ally. It's becoming a province of the German Empire. And then notice, too, the last thing I'd like to point out about this map, second to last thing, the West Coast, Oregon, Washington, and California are labeled Japonica. And this reflects fears that Americans had had for decades that Japan wanted part of the American West Coast. And the last thing I'd like to note, roughly where New Mexico is a little bitty white area there called the American Reservation, reflecting fears that the Germans would put all Americans into one small area, exactly, of course, as the United States had done to the native inhabitants of North America. Now, this map reflected the fears of those Americans who thought that the Wilson administration's policy of neutrality had been wrong. People like Mary Roberts Reinhardt and Theodore Roosevelt and General Leonard Wood, the commander of the American army, who thought that the United States should be doing more to get itself ready, who thought that the United States faced a circle of enemies around them, and people who thought that the First World War wasn't really about what happened to France. The First World War was about what would happen to the United States. The First World War wasn't about Belgium. The First World War wasn't about Serbia. It was about what would happen to the United States. And there were people in 1916, mostly on the left of the American political spectrum, who thought these fears were nonsense, who thought these people were overinflating these fears, that this really could never happen to the United States. And please keep that in mind as I go forward here. Now, as most of you know, just a month after this image appears on the cover of Life magazine, Pancho Villa invaded the United States, raiding Columbus, New Mexico, killing 20 Americans, including a pregnant woman, and showing the United States to be that weak military power that the American right believed it to be. And I can go into more of that if anybody would like in the question and answer. Pancho Villa was arguably the most famous man in North America, behind maybe only Woodrow Wilson. And the United States Army, commanded by John Pershing, not only could not find him, it found itself engaged in military operations that it lost to government forces under Carranza at the Battle of Carrizal in northern Mexico. The American military system had proved itself unable to find Pancho Villa and bring him to justice. So as you can probably imagine, the questions asked in the American media, if it can't find Pancho Villa, how on earth will it fight the German army? How on earth will it defend the soil of the United States against a major operation by Germany, or Germany in concert with Mexico and or Japan? Now, as some of you also, I'm sure most of you know, Woodrow Wilson believed that the Mexican people would welcome American troops on Mexican soil. He believed that the Mexican people would see Americans as liberators. Not for the last time will an American president make this argument. And as you all know, it did not produce the outcome that President Wilson thought it would, leading to even greater fears in the United States that what would happen is that the leaders of the Mexican Revolution and Mexican Civil War, who were anti-American, would turn to Germany as their natural ally. There was an American woman, Maud Hawks, whom Pancho Villa either brought along with or kidnapped, depending upon which version of the story you read, and brought her on the Columbus raid before releasing her. She told the American people that Villa had bragged that he had the Germans behind him and, quote, would kill everybody in the United States and would be helped by the Germans and the Japanese. Raising these fears, the American ambassador to Germany, James Garrard, wrote to President Wilson saying, quote, most Germans think that America's Mexico troubles are to their advantage. I am sure that Villa's attacks are made in Germany. Every night, 50 million Germans cry themselves to sleep because all of Mexico has not risen against us. So there is this fear that what is threatening to America is not what's happening on the other side of the Atlantic Ocean. What's threatening to America is what's happening here in North America. Now, as I noted, there were plenty of Americans who believed that this was all inflated, that people were trying to stoke up fear, that many people on the right in the United States were trying to pull America into a war that was about Europe, not about the United States. All of that changes. Almost 100 years ago, in late February of 1917, when this document is stolen or decoded by the British, this is a telegram, today known as the Zimmermann telegram, that went from the German foreign minister in Berlin, Arthur Zimmermann, to the German legation in Washington using American telegraph lines, from there to the German legation here in Mexico City. The telegram reads, in part, "We intend," meaning Germany, "intend to begin on the 1st of February unrestricted submarine warfare," meaning that the German Navy will start sinking all ships in the North Atlantic, right? The same thing that had sunk the Lusitania. "In the event of this not succeeding," meaning keeping the United States neutral, "we make Mexico a proposal of alliance on the following basis: make war together, make peace together, general financial support, and an understanding on our part," meaning Germany's part, "that Mexico is to reconquer the lost territory in Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona." Okay, let's come back to the map for just a second. Okay. This is Germany promising Mexico that Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico go back to them, go back to Mexico as part of the alliance. "You will inform the president," meaning the president of Mexico, "of the above most secretly as soon as the outbreak of war with the United States is certain." And here's a critical part. "And add the suggestion that he should, on his own initiative, invite Japan to immediate adherence and at the same time mediate between Japan and ourselves." Now, why didn't the Zimmermann telegram mention California, which was also taken from Mexico in the War of 1848? It's to be the lure to bring Japan into the alliance. Now what does that map look like if you're American? Now it looks like it predicted a year early what Germany, Mexico, and Japan were up to. Now there's a fascinating history, but behind this telegram, the British had intercepted it and decoded it, but were afraid to release it because they didn't want the Germans to know that they had Germany's naval codes. So they did something pretty clever. There are two versions of this telegram. The one that went from Berlin to Washington, and then the one that went from Washington to Mexico City. They released the one that went from Washington to Mexico City, the assumption being that the Germans would assume that the leak was on the Mexico end, not on the Germany end. And that's exactly what happens. They show it to the Americans. At one point, President Wilson is afraid to release it because he thinks it's too explosive. The country will have to go to war. He sends two naval experts over to London to confirm that the British had actually decoded it correctly, that it wasn't a trick. And instead of releasing it himself, he gave it to three New York City newspapers who published it at the end of February 1917. In Berlin, Arthur Zimmermann is asked, "Did you really send that telegram? Is this really what you have in mind?" And Arthur Zimmermann said, "Yes. Yes, I did." Now, very quickly, the Mexican government says, "We're not interested, thank you. We don't want war with the United States." And very quickly, Japan says the same thing. But the damage is done. The damage is done. And you can see these two political cartoons here. The one in the top left shows the Kaiser carving up the United States, giving Arizona, Mexico, and Texas to Mexico, and giving California to Japan. And in the bottom right, there is a Mexican figure being given a bag of gold by a demonic and evil-looking Kaiser, with the map showing Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas behind it. This is the moment when the American people decide that they can no longer be neutral. This is the moment when the president's closest advisors tell him that he now has no choice but to declare war. Two members of his own cabinet, including his son-in-law, told him that if he did not declare war, they would resign from the cabinet. In the American Constitution, it is the Senate that declares war. They were afraid that the Senate would declare war without the president. Now, what that tells me is that it is not Woodrow Wilson leading a reluctant country into war. It is, in fact, the opposite. It is the American people deciding that the war is not about Belgium, it's not about France, it's not about England. It is about the integrity of their own country, and that they have sat on the side long enough. Now, if I'm right about this, and I think I am, if I'm right about this, what it means is that the American people went to war for the reason of self-defense. And they did so not with enthusiasm, but with determination. That is, the need to fight off an outside aggressor. And if I'm right about this, in their minds, the job is over on November 11th, 1918, when the Germans agree to sign an armistice, meaning that they no longer have the power to do this to the United States. That's why, as soon as the armistice is signed, the American people begin to demand that their sons, brothers, and husbands return back to the United States. The war in their minds is over. The problem is that for Woodrow Wilson, it's not. Woodrow Wilson now wants to reshape the world in line with what he wrote in his famous 14 points. I want to end with one slide, and then I'll be happy to take any questions that you might have. This is Mary Roberts Rinehart yet again. When she read the Zimmerman telegram, she wrote this piece, which was eventually published in the Saturday Evening Post in March of 1917. Most of this article is about how fearful she was that her son was going to have to join the U.S. Army and that the United States had wasted 2 years since the Lusitania, and the army that her son was going to join would not be ready to fight in the worst war in human history. So she began by saying, if in this war we allow the few to fight for us, then have a nation, as a nation, we have died and our ideals have died with us. She's referring here to the system in the American Civil War where wealthy people could buy their way out of military service. She's saying here that we can't do that in this war because the threat to us is existential. Even if this means my son has to go and fight. Then she wrote, we are virtually at war. By the time this is published, perhaps the declaration will have been made. And you'll note, she wrote this in February. It takes Wilson until April to do that. To Mary Roberts Rinehart, to the governor of New York, to the governor of Massachusetts, the Zimmerman telegram is a declaration of war by Germany against the United States. It's time to go to war. Then she wrote, Britain and France shared parts of America's values and parts of America's ideals. And remember, it is at the same time that all this is happening that the first Russian Revolution takes Tsarist Russia out of the war, meaning that the United States can now claim that it is a war to make the world safe for democracy. That is difficult to do with the Tsar as one of your allies. So all of these things are coming together in this crucial moment in early 1917. Then she ended this by writing, under the domination of Prussia, Germany now threatened those democratic values, not only in Europe, but in the United States itself. For Germany, quote, had broken loose something terrible, something that must be killed or the world dies. Now, that's a very long way from thank heaven we are out of it, right? This is a statement that the United States had tried to stay out of the war, had done everything it could to stay out of the war, but now had no choice but to fight in the worst war in human history. Thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to take any questions that you have. Muchas gracias.